welcome to the Frito Show, Espen Gleditsch.
Thank you so much.
Great to be here, down in Muntergata, in your nice studio here. Yeah, where should we start? Because before we recorded, you were starting on a story that you yeah. that you did journalism in high school.
Yeah, that was more like an anecdote of the interview situation. We were discussing that it's difficult to do interviews, really. Like I said, I have had somewhat of a background in journalism. I started working for the regional newspaper when I was like 16.
Where did you grow up?
Holmestrand. Went to school in Tønsberg, so yeah. I worked there for the paper. Tønsbergblad, which at a time when these kind of papers had quite a bit of a, people were reading it. It was like 100,000 people reading that paper.
Oh, wow, yeah.
And I did that through my studies and
How old were you when you started?
16.
16, yeah.
Yeah.
Till you graduated 18, 19?
Yeah, no, I continued after that freelancing when I was studying abroad and also first years of starting off as an artist, because couldn't live off it, right? Yeah. I didn't get scholarships or stuff like that, so I financed it with writing, really.
Yeah.
But it's been quite a few years since.
But what corner of were you writing about, the cultural stuff?
Mostly, it started off with cultural journalism. I also did some news editorial work.
You get the phone call, jumped into the van.
Exactly, and I hated that stuff. And that's the moment I realized that I didn't have a journalist in me at all.
You didn't have the eagerness to get the pitch.
The other guys, you could like you see it in their eyes. They were like stoked when something happened. I was like,
shit, I have to get out.
So then I went into cultural journalism, which was fun because as a freelancer, you can choose your own fields of interest, really. And it switched quickly into doing a lot of interviews with artists, really. So for me, it was also a way of mapping out what is it like being an artist? Because I didn't grow up with artists in my family or artists around
me.
It was quite abstract, the how to do it kind of section of it.
So what pulled you in? I mean, how did you get interested in it? Through journalism? Just
no, not really. I started. It started off with an interest in photography. Had this great teacher, and when I was in my 10th grade, when you're 15 or something, we had this. There was a dark room at school.
Oh, cool! Yeah.
So and my uncle had a single lens reflex camera, and which I borrowed, and I really liked that from the go.
Yeah.
Before that, I was into music. I was still into music, and I am still into music, but I also played music.
Yeah.
So I was playing in a band and also starting with photography. And after a while there, the photography or the interest in the arts really started totally outgrowing.
The music part.
So it started off with soccer, which is the baseline.
Yeah.
if you grew up in Norway, right? And then turned into music, playing guitar and bass, and then it turned into photography.
What kind of music do you play?
It was like a indie rock band in the millennium shift around area, highly inspired by Sonic Youth and a lot of American Chicago based indie label stuff.
Yeah. Nice.
We recorded an EP, and every now and then I sit down and
I'd love to listen to that one day. Nice. Yeah. So when you were journalizing, how you called when you were a journalist?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you said you were mapping out more and more the art world. But where did you talk to artists? Was it you went to Oslo to talk to artists, or did you talk to the local Tønsberg scene, or was there a scene? at all?
Yeah, or when I was writing for Tønsbergs Blad, then it was like the artists in that area, of yeah. which there are a lot of amazing artists. Yeah. So, yeah, just...
Because Tønsberg, how far? That's like an hour from Oslo?
Yeah, yeah. Roughly.
Yeah.
So, so there's, yeah, and Tønsberg, Åsgårdstrand, Holmstrand, yeah, yeah, there are, it's in Tjøme, there are a lot of artists living out on the islands there.
Yeah.
So,
Is there an artist that really stands out that you still remember, or kind of that?
Oh, there's so many. And these are also my friends after a while. Yeah. Like, so that's very difficult.
That's hard to say.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. But it was a very rewarding time, like, because, like you do now, like stepping into people's studios, yeah, seeing how they work, how it's all connected, really. To me, it really a great eye opener, right?
But how did it inform you? How kind of did it kind of push you in a certain direction through there, or was there like a did you found out you had like a something that interested you more than other things, or was there some kind of defining moment in that, or just a gradual?
That's difficult to answer in a way, because at the same time I was also doing a lot of like traveling, because I started a BA in Prague, which was an amazing school to go to.
Oh, that's insane! How did you get there?
No, first I went to the university here in Oslo for a year, and then I went to this forskola, like this Fata Morgana, it's called, in Copenhagen. It's a yeah. very, very particular school. It's not for everyone, or wasn't yeah. at the time at least. A year
is that photo based, or
yeah,
is
it? Yep. It's photographic art. In Denmark, it holds like this very special position in a way, because there is no higher education specializing in that. It's not like,
and then like art photography.
Yeah. No, it's not like as you had in Norway before with. In Bergen, that you can study art photography, and now it's included in the art academy. But yeah. these are like professors within photography. And in Sweden, there's a school in Gothenburg, but Denmark's never had that. So no. the artists are trained either at art academies, or the artists who are working with photography
yeah.
are either trained at art academies, or some of them are even trained at like journalist schools.
Yeah.
So this school, which was specializing in like this area between
between
photography yeah. as art and extended journalism, was a really interesting place to be with a lot of interesting tutors. And
was it 1 year or 2 years?
That was a 1 year.
1 year.
Yeah. And then from there I went to Prague and started a BA, and which was an amazing place to be.
How big is that school? Is that a small school? No?
It's a big school. It's like, compare it to Kyiv in Oslo in a way, with like four or five like departments.
Yeah.
And I was at the Department of Still Photography. It's
okay.
The film department that's really like the big brother at that school.
Yeah.
Where
I've been showing my kids To Gode Naboer, which comes from Prague, I think, or from Czechia, Czechoslovakia. It comes from it's like this animation children thingies.
Mm.
And I think it was one of the expression forms they kind of nurtured under the curtain, I think.
No, but being in Prague was amazing, but it was also.
Had you been there before you started studying, or did you?
Yes, I've been there a couple of times, and also with what do you call it, like admission trials
yeah.
and stuff like that. But also, I've been there.
Yeah.
But at that time, I was really into darkroom work, black and white darkroom. And in Prague, they really specialized in that,
okay.
which was for me a big deal.
Yeah, because around that time, most academies were just getting rid of that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And but with that, there came other things as well, which made Prague for me not the ideal place, even though I loved being there and the school was amazing in so many ways. It was also most professors were very conservative in
yeah.
their views, even reactionary. To me, I just felt that I spent so much time like kicking in doors that really should have been for quite a while. Let's say I did a project where I wanted to do like appropriation work with photography, which for me was like, of course you can do that. Like post picture generation, it shouldn't be a question really.
No.
And I had so much difficulties just being able to do it. Like, so I spent so much energy for that, and then you do it, and there's no really reception for it
because they don't have no references. They have
no one really is interested, and like it's like this. This wasn't the case for all the professors, of course, but
how about the students?
The students were really nice, but that was also what I started realizing, that because it was more of a old school academy model where the professors had a lot of saying, where you kind of like at the end of the semester you went with your grade book to every single one of them
and they
asking them to like then they like checked you out of their courses.
But it's not like the German system where you have one professor, you study under one professor, so
more like that than the Bauhaus system in a way, but it was sort of a mix of those two, but the professors had a lot of saying, and which is good in a way for schools that the professor had the autonomy, right? But then you need to make sure you pick the right school for you. We had this amazing stuff. We had like courses on chemistry and on the anatomy of the eye and like amazing stuff that I've really been able to use in my practice later. But I also saw that like the higher up in the years, let's say the 3BA, first MA, second MA, like the students, when you were asking them, when they were looking at their negatives over the light table, like, and you asked them something about their work, what is this? When you were looking at your own work, they would come up to you, like the more senior students, asking, and the question would always be, so, who are you doing this for? Which was the professor, right? And I really saw that in a lot of the senior students, that they were like tailoring what they were doing to fit the professors. And I didn't want to be there. I didn't want to quit the school, but I didn't want to be there.
Yeah.
So took a very difficult decision on like leaving. And
so which year did you leave?
I went the first year only.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So you didn't quit halfway, but you said like a second year. Okay. Sorry. I'm not. Not for me. Yeah.
And then I moved back to Norway.
That must have been a really tough decision because
I remembered
you travel like pretty far, you know, establish yourself, and then you decide.
And you feel kind of stupid, isn't the word, but
there's like, some kind of defeat, maybe.
Difficult because what I foresaw at that time was that I was going to do transfer to another school, right?
Yeah.
But I kind of got scared, like thinking that if I managed to like choose the wrong school once, what stops me from doing it again? And then it kind of started grinding, right? And I started, okay, let's take a year off, and then I went back to Norway and I started working with journalism on the side and got a studio, made sure I had all the equipment I needed to make work.
Yeah.
But
then you were still doing like black and white photography?
No, then I was...
You went digital.
Or I was film-based, scanning it, and then outputting it digital by that time. And then journalism was really... how I like was able to finance this because I was like totally outside of everything. Like I was just someone who done year school in Prague and was living in Holmstrand, having a studio, running around with a Hasselblad camera.
Yeah.
And at that time I was doing all these interviews with the artists. I knew that quitting the school, I realized after a while when I saw that I wasn't going to transfer into anything anytime soon.
No.
Because, and then I realized that, okay, this is also, could also be a way into becoming an artist, but I also knew that doing that it would take me so much more time.
It takes more
than
time,
someone
yeah.
who
yeah.
comes out of, let's say, an academy.
Because what you say, like when you're young, you're just in high school and you start to figure out like nobody tells you, you can just be an artist. You can just decide to be an artist, right? But you're absolutely right. It will take you a lot longer than if you go through that kind of ringer of an art school.
Exactly.
But it's not, the one is not lesser than the other. It's just a different way of dealing with it.
And for me, I kind of ended up with both experiences, but because I did that, and then kind of the, like, things started moving, right? Like, I was making work, and it was gradually going places. I was getting into museum shows and stuff like that, and it was really encouraging, of course, for me, because this was what I wanted to do. And I was making sure that, like, since I wasn't going to school, that I also traveled a lot, like seeing shows, like,
you're just getting input.
Just making sure to get out internationally, seeing stuff, getting like input. And also at a period there, I was also working at Preus Museum, and Jonas Ekberg was the director, which was a very nice period. And through that period also, the what do you say, the division really between the journalism and
the photography
and my art started to bleed into each other. Like, I started making a lot of like what would be able to be called like reportage based projects. I would like write texts, go somewhere, photograph, and that comes out of the journalistic experience. And I still kind of work like that. It doesn't always evolve into a text, but sometimes it does. And that's very similar to the reportage, even though it's not, the photographs are, of course, not illustrations.
But I know what you mean.
It's what comes first in this case.
But
it's a method that I've
And that kind of started out when you moved back to Norway. And really
kind of did. And when I
had to survive by doing journalism. And
yeah, and also seeing other artists working like that. I remember it was such an eye opener for me to see the Danish artist Joachim Køsted, who works in this manner where he goes somewhere with his camera and he documents something or photographs something that's typically impossible to photograph, like something that doesn't exist, like and then he writes a text that's in connection to that, and they're shown together in the museum or gallery space. And when he, for example, did a project called The Kant Walks, where he goes to Königsberg, or Kaliningrad, which is now former Königsberg, where Kant lived, where Kant was, I'm not familiar with the details anymore, but he's supposed to never left that place more than like 30 kilometers
out of there
once in his life or something. And he did this daily walks that he writes about in his journal or his diary. And so what Joachim Køsted did was he took a map of Königsberg from that time, mapping out Kant's routes for walking, and then he took a contemporary map of Kaliningrad, put this route on top, and just went that route and photographed and wrote a text about Kant and his walks. And to me, like, seeing that stuff, it was mind-blowing. That way of being able to work with history and photography has been with me ever since,
really. So just to pull back a bit, so when you moved back, do you remember kind of the first, what type, maybe not the first picture, but what type of pictures you started making then?
I mean, I did a lot of different things, but I did, but one thing that really, I started working on this project about a mountain, really, a specific mountain in Holmestrand, the city where I'm from, small place, 10,000 inhabitants by the sea. Which is divided by this 80 meter tall
rock
mountain kind of way. And so I worked in so many ways with this mountain. And one of the most rewarding things was when I started mapping out ways to go down that mountain from the plateau on top to the base. And really like finding every single way that could be used now or were in use previously but couldn't be used anymore because of because of
vegetation maybe or
more permanent stuff, like let's say building of roads and stuff, so they had like chop off pieces of the mountain and different things. And so I walked this route with my with a video camera. I bought like a video camera and like handheld walking down this route. It's like from the top to the bottom. It could be like 15 minute video, could be 35 minute, and like just mapping it, really bringing that together in the gallery space with running on monitors, all of them, and like following all these walks.
So that was one of the first projects you did. And did you initiate this yourself, or was this initiated because of an exhibition?
This was initiated by myself. Yeah, I didn't really know where it was gonna go at all.
No. So it was
just an interest, really, in the typography of the place where I grew up.
Yeah,
and this wasn't really like that. This wasn't really like journalistic in a way.
No.
It was kind of an interest into land art and that kind of stuff. That bled in. I was looking to, like I said, Joachim Koester, but also Hamish Fulton and also Ronnie Horn and these kind of figures at that time.
And besides photography, I mean, you take a lot of pictures of sculptures these days.
Yes, I have been doing that a bit lately.
So, so besides photography, what art forms kind of draw your attention most or
looking at or
looking experience working, but also working with maybe or
because I have been working with quite a few things but for quite a few years it's been photography and text on and off really that I've been working mostly with, but I've also been working doing projects that are sound based and sculptural. See what more, but video, which bleeds into photography, of course. But and my interest in working with sculpture really came through photography. It started with because my work with sculptures have always been about the colors of sculptures, the colors that are. Have disappeared really from.
Like with the as you were saying at Kunstnerverbund now where. We have this blue from the only pigment they found from the
Parthenon sculptures at the British Museum. A current show I have at Kunstnerverbund where I photographed the Parthenon sculptures,
which everybody has to go and see, by the way.
you're warmly welcome. So I've been working with colors disappearing. Where do they go, kind of? And also this idea of the narrative of the white, the untainted surface, really.
And the myth of that.
Yeah, and how that came across or came into being. And working with that started with architecture for me, with modernist architecture and how that turned monochrome or white, and how photography played a role in that. And I was highly intrigued by that as a photographer when I realized that or read the hypothesis that photography may have shaped modern architecture.
Oh, wow.
That black and white photography made that architecture whiter. And that struck me, and I've been working with that in several ways, and through that it made sense to
dig in these old
to look at the most emblematic case of colors missing or gone missing, which is at least in our part of the world or our cultural sphere, the antique Greek and Roman statues, the marble statues, really. Even though everyone knows now that they've been and have known for quite a while that they've always been painted in vivid colors, looking like Marvel comics, then it's difficult to envision them as something other than white. And this, how these kind of narratives established, that's really a great interest for me. So in a way photography led me to sculpture in this case.
Because then you have on these pictures in Kunstnerverbund, some have like the blue gradient, the disappearing blue, but also the white gradient, and some have none.
Some have none, yeah. About like almost half of them have gradients, and I've been working with this before with a previous project where I photographed canonized Greek and Roman marble sculptures and brought the colors back in a way, not bringing them back to the sculptures or specifically, but
including not coloring them, in.
No,
but, yeah.
including them as a filter that you see
them through. Yeah.
Through.
Yeah.
So as a printed foil on the frame glass, it's like gradients of colors. And this was a continuation of that, where it's done in a different way at Kunst der Verbindung now, which has a very different materiality. So a lot of them are white pigment on the glass,
mm-hmm.
which is like opaque or semi-opaque, so you get this like softening effect.
Yeah,
it dissolves the image behind.
Yeah, especially since the sculptures are whitish and
it totally bleeds into each other, right? And what was interesting for me with doing that was how the idea of this whiteness always or often stands in the way of these sculptural works, or gets in the way, either if it's how we perceive them or through how they're
represented,
restoration processes, etc. That they're always made to cohere to this ideal. And I wanted to get that back into the work, or my work, really, this whiteness that gets in the way, really, of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it obstructs, really, at the same time that it...
But it still...
It kind of breathes life into, oddly enough.
It gives an extra depth, because it really hit me, like, especially the one next to the blue one on the blue wall, that it got so three-dimensional, you know?
Yeah.
Because your pictures are so sharp and so kind of precisely... leveled out with the shades and the gradients and stuff, but then also the gradient layer on top kind of gives it an extra depth or something. So that really,
I'm glad that you mentioned it, because that's really been one of the things that I've been working with a lot in this in these works, both through the photographing and editing and printing, and also the glass, this interplay between three-dimensionality and flatness, really.
Yeah.
And because it's like photographing, in this case, the Parthenon frieze, which is marble reliefs, with doing that with photography, which is a flattening medium, outputting it on paper, which is mounted on aluminum, perfectly flat.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it could easily become very flat.
Yeah.
So in every step of the way here, it was like, how can I accentuate three dimensionality or the
textuality, or whatever you want to call it. Yeah.
Yeah, and making them almost like not lifelike, but having a presence in the room, really.
Mm-hmm.
The objects that are photographed, that they have a presence in the room of their own, an agency, that it's not just the works of art.
The presence. Yeah, it's not just the. I see what you see. But you took all the pictures at the British Museum?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm. So did you get permission to the, or did you just sneak in and?
It's often easier not to ask.
Not to ask. Yeah. But did you brought a tripod?
You cannot bring tripods.
That's why I'm thinking. Yeah. So you really have to.
So these are photographed on like the very like liminal state of what you can. I was there in February.
Not the best of light.
It's an amazing light, but it's not enough of it, right? and for me, previously I've been working with like large format film photography, 4x5 negatives, and then you can't do that stuff without a tripod. It's impossible. And when I do these kind of works, I work handheld, which is such a different way to work. And with the...
Yeah, because you need that sharpness, right? Because otherwise
in this case, it's been working, like, let's say, on like the minimum what you would term like an accepted level of everything. It would be working on the highest or the largest aperture of your camera or my camera, which is for the photographers who are listening, like you know this, like that this is a medium format digital camera and the depth of field becomes almost nothing. And also working handheld on the uttermost like length of time of exposure that you can, that I'm able to handhold my camera.
And
when you're shooting like 6 hours a day, then you get really tired from lifting like a couple of kilos of camera.
You have to lift it, you have to breathe in
the
picture. It becomes a physical experience.
I'm so exhausted after a day of photographing because I hold my breath so much.
Yeah.
It's a very physical act. But there's so much of my practice which is research based, kind of having an idea of what I'm going into before I go. But what I both love and hate about my process is that I never know what I'm gonna get into before I get there.
Yeah.
And typically, like let's say I'm going a week to London, then something is really at stake. It needs to work.
It needs to be 1 week, and that's it.
And especially if it's gonna be a show, if there's a date already set, and it just needs to work. And I going there, having something at stake, and also working highly intuitively with photography, and which is the most intuitive part of my process, really. And I love it when I get into it.
But it's a bit scary too.
It is very scary, and I'm always totally anxious before I leave for whatever I go to photograph. Like what if X happens, there's no light, what if there's restrictions, what if la la la, you never know. That's just me. I guess.
No, but you I think that's also like an excitement you need. That's, I would say, maybe like a hidden motivation as well. Because if you're on that edge, you know, you heighten your sensibilities, you heighten your kind of your looking, and you have to problem solve real fast, and so you have to have all your wits with you, and you feel alive, right?
Yeah, it works. It's I couldn't. I don't think I really could work that many other ways.
So how many pictures do you have in the show now?
It's 15 large photographs in that show.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's also a book where there's an extended take on the project, which is 50 images.
Yeah.
The book is going to be launched at Kunstnerforbundet the 11th of October.
Good. With, again, everybody should be there.
Yes.
Get the book.
Also, you should be there because the amazing Mari Lending, professor in architectural history or in history and theory at the architecture school in Oslo, has written an amazing essay in that book. And she's going to give an introduction.
It's the 11th of October.
Yeah,
right.
6 o'clock. And after that, there's going to be a conversation between Mari and artist Dag Erik Elgin and myself.
Nice.
Dag Erik is also my former professor at the Art Academy in Oslo. I did after a few years of just working with myself.
You did the master's, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And you, when were you there again? You were like two.
I graduated in 2015.
Yeah, 15. Mm. Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, I think I already worked there.
You were.
And now we're both gone again.
Yes.
So after a couple of years, because you had about 3 or 4 years in between?
No, I think I had 8 years in between.
8 years, yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Before, wanting to get into, go back to school.
But, you know, to kind of refer what you said earlier, okay, if you do it yourself, it just takes longer.
Mm.
And I would say about double as long before
probably,
you kind of
probably.
Yeah. So then eight.
And also, it's not just time, I guess, because of course there is stuff that you pick up at an art academy that's highly rewarding, right? Yeah. So much interesting stuff going on at an art academy, like the curriculum that you go through. Like I loved it. Like,
yeah.
So
yeah. I mean, it's just a denser version of what you. Yeah.
Yeah, and for me, really, it was so nice going back after being out of it for quite a few years, because then I was so in a way like I really appreciated everything that was there. It was like this buffet of amazing stuff.
Yeah.
I signed up with tutorials with every single person coming
through
my
school. You're probably, because you've been out there, you know how valuable it is.
Yeah, I loved it. Those two years were just amazing. I loved every minute of it.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. It's such a privilege being at an art academy. It really is. An amazing bubble.
Yeah, it is. It's a complete bubble. It has nothing to do with any reality, but it is. It's a pressure chamber somehow.
Mm. Yeah,
and, oh, that's absolutely true. Künstlerverbünde. How long did you work on that show? You know,
It's been around for in a way in the back of my head for quite a few years.
Yeah.
Let's say 3 years, perhaps. But the first photographs were made in February this year. So now we're in September, right?
Yeah. But just formalizing, thinking, kind of creating the energy to do it.
Yeah, I have been saying like usually in the past that. Around like let's say 80% of my project is kind of set or done when I pick up a camera.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that's the case with this project, a lot of stuff happens before a camera comes into place. I don't start with the photography. I don't like think through photography.
No.
Photography comes in at a later point, really, for me.
Yeah, for me, it's the reverse. I just take the pictures and then something comes out of there. Yeah.
Mm.
But it's an interesting approach too. Yeah, because a lot happens thinking and writing then for you to start.
Yeah, researching really beforehand. But going into a thematic, and then I go really or relatively broadly into it, really, not limiting myself at all. And that's for me the most rewarding period of any project, where everything can happen and I just go into it, and I love getting my hands into it, like ordering books, sitting, reading,
Do you make book lists for the projects you do?
No,
like,
not
like,
really.
No,
it's just
too bad.
A stack of books.
It would have been.
Yeah,
it would have been nice to see kind of like the
literature
pattern.
List.
Yeah,
If you're interested in the show, go read this. Yeah, that would be.
Here you got 50 books. There you go.
Yeah. Because the thing is that most of that stuff I get into there.
Yeah,
it doesn't. I can't really say that it's necessarily visible within the specific works in the show. But for me, I know that I would never have...
No, but it is for you to get into a certain headspace more than...
You would never be able to backtrack it from the works in the show. But for me, I would never be able to arrive at that point
without going through
that.
Yeah.
So it's a broad base from which something very specific evolves.
Yeah.
Not in a linear way at all. And typically this is also where it jumps into becoming future projects, right?
Yeah.
From like other stuff getting into.
Yeah, because I wanted to get to that question. Like, do you work on one project at a time, or you have like an array of projects which which what
typically
parallel?
There is more than one at a time. Yeah, yeah. Two, three, something like that.
Two, three. Yeah. Because I imagine if you have more than that, it becomes hard to handle or
especially or, at least for me. I think. Yeah, I'm sure people are able to do that, but I need to really get into it. Really, mm-hmm. for me, I need quite a bit of time.
And let's say you work on two, three projects. Are they? Are they in relation with each other, or can they be like really kind of different from each other as well?
I'm not really sure if any project I've ever done is really different from any other project I've done, to be fair. But I would love for that to be the case. But they often have like
these overlaps
in
yeah.
some way. Yeah. So, but so often there is something there, like a red thread that connects. It's often an interest in something that takes different forms, really, for me.
So we're looking at in your studio at a print, test prints, I guess.
These are test, on the walls now are test prints from my latest book, proofs, really, for the book.
But this is the one that will be out in October now.
Yes.
Oh, I look forward to that book. Let's see, where can we jump to from now? So what's on the menu in the future? What
I'm working towards a few shows which are not at the moment announced by the venues, so I can't really go detailed into that before they do. But right now I opened the show last week, so now I'm just trying to like recuperate, really get into.
You need a long time to kind of land.
I wish I had a lot of time to land, because typically around the show there's so much going on, it's so busy, and there's a lot of other stuff that needs doing and gets neglected, and so the to-do list is crazy.
It's getting longer and longer
after an opening. So and also I have two small kids, and before I could lie on the couch for a week after opening a show, until I got so tired of it that I just felt like going out doing something else, something new. That's totally non-compatible with my lifestyle now.
It sounds very familiar.
Yeah, like every minute is so precious of the studio time.
So naturally you would have a calm down time. So how do you solve that now? I'm just interested to see kind of how. Yeah, because we have all these coping mechanisms to stay sane, basically. Because it takes a lot out of you doing a show, and just the intensity of having something concluded, having the attention on it, having all that energy released, and then you're gonna be a bit empty. And so, do you have a process to replenish yourself, or to kind of even in this kind of dense form, is there something you
I have stuff I do, like because it is definitely this, like having a show or an opening is this dopamine rush, right? And then what comes after that isn't always the best feeling.
It can be quite dark. All the self-doubt, self-pity, insecurities and blackness will appear sometimes.
But what I love about completing like a project or opening a show is that up until that point, often it's been such a hectic period up towards it. Like in this case, it was such a long period before the summer, which was busy producing the works, and after the summer, busy producing the book. So and the summer was just
gone,
being out of Oslo with my kids and my partner, and so there's been such a long time that I haven't seen people. Like I've seen my family and my studio, and so that's one of the things to cope with it, really, and that I find really rewarding after opening a show, having the time to see colleagues, friends, discussing stuff, like art, whatever.
Just getting in touch with people again.
But also in like this friend and also professional manner. Going just through the ordinary,
checking in again.
Being with people who are doing interesting stuff. So for now, this is my first week after the show. I'm trying to meet up with people for having lunch, coffee in the morning, etc. Just talking with people what they do.
Because you go into the bubble, and then.
You need to put some stuff into that bubble.
So instead of hanging on the couch, that's more your process now to get back to yourself.
Just running around doing all kinds of follow-up work relating to the show and other things that needs to be done right now. Now it's been a busy period.
But the other thing is also you get more used to it over the years. So you probably, you need less time to... If you do it healthy, you need less time to recuperate, maybe.
Yeah, and also for me, I would say that something happened when I got kids. One thing is that you're more economical about your time.
You have to.
Because you have these few hours between you drop them off in kindergarten and you're going to be back home with them, right? But also, it was very rewarding for me because to... how kids put things in a perspective for you in a way.
You're not the most important person in your life anymore.
And your art isn't either.
No.
And that's a good thing.
And that's so healthy. It kind of, because it actually liberates you more than it kind of imprisons you.
Because my artistic process has always in a way been kind of a process where I've wanted, or where it's been good to get more of a more fuck it ism into it. And getting kids kind of brings that really it as a necessity.
You just have to let go. You can't control even less than you normally can.
So going at it going at it at details forever. I'm micromanaging I'm particular about that kind of stuff. I am, and that's something
how granularly you go, how deep you go, that probably changed after you have kids. You get the same precision, but you don't do the unnecessary steps you would normally have done.
That's exactly what often happens. And I couldn't have done that if I was 22 and got kids, because you can only do it because you've done it before and you have some experience. But my, I'm the kind of guy who always needs to check out all the other alternatives.
Options,
even though I tend to end up with what I started with or a variation of that. And eliminating that possibility and going down every route is just making really rewarding. And it sounds like that's that it gets less of a potential of welcome unintentional things happening.
I would argue for the opposite.
Yeah, because you get more intuitive.
You take all the side roads, and all the interesting thing on the side roads can suddenly influence also kind of that small tweak you need for the main road, so to say, to make it just that bit better. But it is a time and concentration. I think a lot of people don't have the dedicated time or the concentration. I have the capacity to kind of get that concentration to do that, to find all these paths, because it's very intense. But you have to be a bit more economical with it.
You have kids. We used to have kids in the same daycare even.
No, that changed quite a bit. I used to produce at Kio quite a bit because I was living around the corner, and so I could go back at night and stuff like that. And I can't anymore. Same as you, I have to put it in the box in between. And if I'm lucky, I can do an hour in the evening if I have the energy. So you have to be much more precise, and that means you have to do what you do. You have to do much more thinking beforehand. So you make all the mistakes in your head or you know, in the digital media. You know, I do a lot of my sketching in 3D programs and stuff like that. So you do all the mistakes there and all the thinking there before you really, really start producing. Because making mistakes in the real production takes about 10 times more time than if you do. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's also
and kind 10 of, times as costly as well. Yeah. Yeah.
That's kind of rewarding working with photography, though. That when, let's say, when I'm photographing in the British Museum, that I can, you can just like, you can bring back like so many like exposures, and then but then editing turns then, into hell. But because then that
you have to go through it. Yeah.
But then at least you have the the possibilities of shaping the project when you come back.
Yeah. No, I do that. Like I when I go travel and take pictures, I come back with 8,000, 10,000 pictures. I have to go through them, and you know, takes a while.
It really does.
Yeah.
And for me, this is like the. I have been working digitally with projects before, but not in the extent of this one. So it's been a very different process really for me.
But when you were in the British Museum, like, were the people reacting to you, or did they leave you alone?
There's so many people there, and people are sitting around doing sketches, all, like art students. It is a site of production in a way.
Yeah.
And there was at one point when I was like, because there is...
Yeah, because if you spend like 6 hours in a museum,
in
like somebody's
6 days in a row.
Yeah, somebody's going to notice you, right?
Of course, yes.
I mean,
hope that
the people at the entrance might recognize you again. And
no, but it was at one point when, because there is this one section of the frieze that you can actually get really close to, because they have these like dividers in the floor on the floors, right?
Yeah.
So you can't get
it gets closer
than.
Yeah.
What is it, like a meter or something like that?
Yeah.
But there is a corner where you can get really up close by a door. And I did some,
some
really
close,
up close,
close up,
work.
Yeah. So you had a guard over your shoulder.
I'm not going to bore you with the technical details, but the way I was doing it, I was so close to the stone. I had my camera, let's say, like, 20 centimeters from it or something, and and that's too close really for a museum
for them
like
they started
even
get...
though I was very particular with getting in touch or touching,
but they don't know that, you know.
No. And I did after doing that kind of work, like I was, because it the field of focus is so narrow there, so I was like leaning in on the work while like holding the shutter down, like doing multiple exposures in hope
that one
like
of them
catch.
Would be good. Yeah.
And after doing that for a few hours, like really up close, there was this guard, a young woman who came up to me and asked, like, so
did you get the picture?
I can see that you're very careful, but I'm just curious, what is it you're doing? No, I'm just trying to photograph detail. and then by then I was already done.
So yeah,
I was
so
like,
you could
okay,
get it.
I get it.
Yeah, I get the memo.
I'm gonna round the day.
No, because I imagine if you're so intensely there, like you get some reactions, you know, because like probably the guard said, he's still there. You know, today, when they switch out Oh, that's super nice. Maybe we should just close it up at this nice anecdote.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. So much fun.
Thank you for having me and for coming to my studio.
Great. All right. Bye-bye, everyone.